Hi everyone, Meeks cutting in here to say that this episode does talk about rape and sexual assault because of the governor and Maggie, and also talks a lot about the torture of Glenn and a lot of things. If you choose not to engage with that conversation, no problem. We will see you on the other side with episode 8 of season 3, Made to Suffer. All right, enjoy.
Keep talking shit about prisons.
I think we should, just like we keep talking shit about cops. Okay, it's all good.
Yeah. Oh, this is when Daryl's like, do they have muscle? And she's like, some paramilitary whatevers. And I just wrote, Daryl, yes, brother muscle. Welcome to Don't Podcast Dead Inside, because when you look at us, all you see is just another dead podcast. I'm Margo Connolly.
And I'm C. Meeks Meeker, and this is a show rewatching The Walking Dead, spoiler-free from the beginning, and also talking about things that we like, and not so much about the things that we don't like, except in this episode where we're probably going to talk a lot about sexual assault, which we don't like.
I know, you started saying that, and I was like, I think we spend almost more time talking about the things we don't like compared to the things we do like. It's a thin line.
It is a very thin line. It is a very thin line.
Yeah, because today... We're talking about season 3, episode 7, When the Dead Come Knocking, which was written by Frank Renzulli and directed by Dan Sackheim. And it aired on November 25th, 2012, a Thanksgiving miracle. Yeah, Meeker, what did you think about this episode?
So last episode, I was unimpressed, right? Like, it was just like, it was a lot of setting the table. This episode is way more interesting. There's a lot more going on. And it pays off in certain ways. I, again, am paying attention a lot to the different ways in which we're using the word safe and when we mean it versus when we don't mean it. And who says it sort of kind of differently from the other one in terms of Rick versus Governor. This episode, though, also has, like, the torturing of Glenn and Maggie, and that's hard. It's very difficult to see, to watch, and I know we're going to get into it, because of course we're going to get into it, and I think there's a lot to be said for how The Walking Dead treats sexual assault, because it could be worse, which is, like,
that's
the bar.
That's a high bar.
it's what we hold things to worse. These days. I mean, it's not Game of Thrones. This is what I'll say. It's not Game of Thrones.
You know? Don't even get me...
So, I mean, on the whole, though, I really do like this episode. I like what's happening. I love the reunion with Carol and the group. It is so good. She is so good. I love Michonne being there and having her own agenda and also sizing them up constantly and trying to figure out if she thinks she can trust them. It's not like if she's going to kill them. It's just like, can I trust you? Are you actually good people? And I like watching her game that out. But yeah, then we have, and I like watching Merle shift over this episode because he does. It's not focus, but yeah, go ahead.
I also will say I really enjoy in this episode the contrast that we're getting between Rick and the Governor, but also between Rick and Merle, right? Of like, who is a good brother. Like, I love that we're setting kind of, and also between Daryl and Merle, right? I love the end of the, I mean, we'll talk about it at the end of the episode, but I love the cutting back and forth between Merle and Daryl's faces at the end of the episode. I'm like, yes, this is what, this is why I was like, yay, Merle's back. Because as we see in this episode, Merle is a fucking horror show. And as a person, I don't want him back. But cutting back and forth between him and Daryl, yes, that's what I'm here for. I'm here for the tension of that and looking at that in more depth. I'm not here for Merle like fucking everything up.
Like, yeah, well, maybe we should just hop into it because Merle is in full force at the very top of this, and I have a lot of feelings about that knife.
Yeah, let's also note, maybe it's useful before we start, we don't always talk about the episode title, but I like this episode title. And I who do you think the when the dead come knocking, who do you think the dead are that are knocking in this? I have 3 ideas.
Oh, I'm so excited to hear. Yeah, I did clock the episode title, and then I also clocked when people knocked. Milton knocked about Mr. Coleman, and then we have the walker literally knocking to get into to try to get Glenn, and then Glenn doesn't go down because Glenn's Glenn. I don't know.
Oh yeah, those aren't either of mine.
Fantastic.
I think Merle is literally in the first second of this episode is like someone back from the dead, and his little knifey hand is knocking its way down the table towards Glenn. I think Michonne at the gate is like the dead come knocking, right? Because she sort of is like disguised by Guts at the beginning of it and is in the, you know, throng of walkers. Who else? Carol, right? Mm-hmm. Although that would work better for the last episode for her when she was like trying to knock out, like when her little pushing on the door was kind of knocking. And Oh, I guess Milton was one of my other ones. But
I think those work like this, much better.
But I like this title. I think it's a good title, and I love that you could kind of read it into a bunch of different situations, which I appreciate. But yeah, this
agreed.
We really do start with Merle back from the dead and his gone hand. His hand is not back from the dead, but he has this fucking knife. And he's walking his knife arm down the table. Glenn is duct taped to a chair at the end of the table. It's a great shot, right? Because we don't see Merle's face. We just see the knife hand, like, going chunk, chunk, chunk. It's like walking with little fingers, but Merle doesn't have fingers, so he's just, like, stumping the knife into the table. And Glenn looks stoic as fuck.
It's so scary. This whole thing, this is just a further reminder, like, if people had started to get complacent with Merle from Woodbury, now they're like, oh, no, this is just Merle from where Merle was originally from. This is Merle, is what it feels like, right? Like, he is very scary. He is not approachable. He is menacing as all get out. You know, mm-hmm. he's also, like, rewriting history in a way that, like, is very, you know, just to justify his actions, right? He's like, I lowered my gun, but you raised yours. You know, this is all your fault.
It's so funny because it's the thing where it's like, it is literally true. Merle did lower a gun. Merle, mm-hmm. you forgot to mention that other fucking gun. Like, and it's also, you know, and I agree, he's back in full force, right? Glenn says this thing about because Merle is just relitigating the rooftop. Clearly he has not gotten over it. Because he was so messed up the last time we saw him on that rooftop. Like, I don't think he'd forgive anybody for leaving him in a position where he got that desperate, like, and that vulnerable. He can't. But he's relitigating that, and Glenn is like, we went back for you. Me, Rick, Daryl, T-Dog, and Merle just lets loose this, like, insanely vile trash about T-Dog. It's so racist. And I just wrote, oh, the return of Merle's racism. How I've missed it. I haven't missed it. But I did miss in Woodbury that we were kind of rewriting history with him, right? That we were kind of pretending that wasn't a thing that motivated him. And I'm glad that it's back, just to agree with your point, right? I'm ready for us to be back to real Merle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also just further shows, like, the control that the governor had on Merle to really keep Merle in check in front of, you know, the other people in the camp, just to be like, no, okay, like, you can be my hammer in my toolbox, but mm-hmm. Out in the world, you are going to be a paintbrush. I don't know, right? Like, something that is, like, yeah. not something that is not broadcasting exactly what you are at all seconds of the day.
Well, it's the thing where it's like the story that he told whatever the tour guide he was fucking before Andrea, where she was like, our town is perfect. And sure, there's some, like, gross shit outside the walls that the men who, like, go out do. I can't remember what it was, right? There's, like, some strung up walkers or something.
Right.
And she's like, but they've, like, seen a lot and they need a way to, like, vent. And it's like it's like Merle has written himself as a normal person who has seen a lot and sometimes needs to, like, vent by, like, doing a walker fight or going outside the wall and, like, killing and mutilating walkers or whatever. But this is the reminder, right? Merle was this bad before any, like, Walking Dead trauma hit him. He has his own shit. So mm-hmm. it is just kind of this reminder of, like, yeah, Merle's able to play that role in front of everyone else, and now we're seeing, like, but that's a role, right? It's not that he's, like, a normal person who has been pushed too far. He's got his own whole really complicated thing going on. Yeah. And just poor, and also, though, like, poor Glenn in this moment to, like, hear Merle, like, spewing this really absolutely vile bullshit about T-Dog and being like, is he still there? Because I can't wait to get my fucking hands on him is the gist of it. That's not what he actually says. And Glenn's, like, sad little face when he just has to be like, he didn't make it, or we lost him. I didn't write down exactly what he says. But this moment of, like, yeah, he lost T-Dog a day and a half ago. We're back to crazy time again. Like, it's really crazy time. All of this is the same day as the phone calls, Meeker. Rick literally went from wandering the basement insane and hallucinating like 15 minutes ago, and now he's in charge of a major rescue operation. But like poor Glenn, he just lost his friend, and he's having to hear this like racist asshole be like, I can't wait to like find your friend again and kill him. And Glenn's like, well, he's already dead. So,
oh, I was just going to say, like, this is too, like, when we start to get the intercut scenes of Maggie in the other room just listening to this other side.
I know, it's so fucking horrible. I know, right before we do that, we get Merle being like pushing about Daryl, right? And his face when he's pushing about that is so intent. Like, the rest of it's just decoration. This is the main thing. And that's when he's like, maybe the farmer's daughter will help me out. And that's when we cut to Maggie, because Glenn blinks, right? Merle says this shit about Maggie, Glenn blinks, and then we go to Maggie listening to it. Ugh. And I just really want to say at the top of this, Lauren Cohen does like really amazing work in this episode, because I think she has like less than a minute of speaking, right? All of it is like reacting to other things, and I think she does a really good job.
She does. She
and also, does. Like, I just think about this sometimes of, like, how hard it is to, like, physically make your body act scared. So
it's really fucking scary. And Merle continues to sort of, tease is the wrong word, but just sort of infantilize and trying to, like, rile Glenn up. But, of course, you know, Glenn is Glenn. But, you know, he's, like, moving his knife all over his face while he's talking about... Well, he's talking about Maggie's trembling skin and all this other kind of stuff that's just so clearly trying to get to Glenn, and it's working, except he's also Glenn, and so he's trying to hold it together.
He's being so insanely stoic in this episode. It is wild.
Then Merle says this thing about like, oh, I remember, you don't scare easily, right? And that's when he like threatens basically to cut off Glenn's nose with his bayonet knife. And I every single time, like, oh my God, please don't do that. His beautiful face, please don't do that.
Don't do it in his face. I'm going to sneeze. Yeah, I know. Oh, it's horrible. And I do love that Glenn does fight back, right? I think it's right after Merle throws a little like gentle racism Glenn's way, right? Where he's like, I do remember you. You don't scare easily. You're the sneaky one. And Glenn does headbutt Merle in the face and give him an insanely bloody nose, but it's not enough. And that's when it's like, oh my God, he's really going to cut Glenn's nose off. And this is, I was saying this to Meeker earlier, but this is the episode that I stopped. I've tried The Walking Dead a couple of times. And the first time I stopped here because I didn't want to watch them hurt Glenn. I couldn't stand it. I'm going to sneeze again. But yeah, no, I couldn't. I couldn't deal with it. But as I was saying to Meeker earlier, that was I think I maybe didn't finish the whole episode, because really, or that was the reason I said to my friend when I was like, I stopped watching, they're hurting Glenn. And I can't actually see myself saying they're hurting Glenn and not saying they're torturing Maggie. So I do wonder if I jumped ship before the end of the episode, if I was just like, the beating of Glenn was too graphic for me.
So the only other things that I have are, as you already pointed out, the headbutt, but also that Merle continually says that I want to know where my brother is. And then he also says, I want to know where Rick is. I want to know, you know, and like, and that's how we leave it, as he's like sort of pummeling.
And I think we ended with hearing him through the wall be like, I want to know where my brother is, and hearing the sound of punching as Maggie like has to sit and listen to all of it. Yeah, credits, whatever. And then we're right back where we left off, which is how I know that it's been not even 15 minutes since Rick pulled all his marbles back into a bag. And he's like, I'm ready, you guys. I'm back. You know, Rick is kind of going, and he's made super good eye contact with Michonne through the fence. Michonne doesn't say anything. And everyone else is kind of creeping in, like, what's happening? Why is Rick walking so close to the fence? You know, she got that far because she was camouflaged by the, like, Walker gut bag that she punctured with her katana. But her bloody wound where Merle shot her, right, is ruining her camouflage. It's leaking, and the Walkers are starting to realize she's there. And Rick's just kind of watching.
He really doesn't know what he wants to do in this situation. I mean, Carl even asks, are we going to help her dad? Like, what do we do? And he, like, Rick is still not sure. And then Michonne has to start fighting for her life because he's still not sure. And so she starts fighting for her life and kicks ass because she's Michonne.
She kicks fucking ass. She really is good at handling her own, even all messed up like she is. But she's so messed up.
Yeah.
She takes out, like, easily five walkers by herself before she starts to go down. And it's not even, like, that the walkers are getting the best of her. I think blood loss is starting to get the best of her. Because this is this one of the shots you were talking about earlier? Like, when she starts to, when she faints, essentially, and we see the, like, camera.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Like, one of the, sorry, I was thinking because we were just talking about her gunshot wound.
Yeah. I know. Do you remember that part where she took, like, a Civil War pistol out of her back pocket and just started blowing walkers away?
No. This is definitely one of those shots because, yeah, she's all delirious, and so everybody's looking fuzzy to her as they're coming, you know.
And it's like, and she's getting tunnel vision a little bit, right? Yeah. From, like, it's closing in. And she faints. I know. Carl yells, "Should we help her?" And let's note, I wrote spoilers. They do help her. And Carl really plays a huge role in helping her.
He shoots. He shoots a lot of stuff.
He shoots. I think he's the one that makes the decision that they're going to do it, right? Because he shoots through the fence before Rick is even to him, right? He shoots two walkers, and then it's like, Rick's like, well, we're committed now. And he goes out, and I wrote, good shots, everybody. Lots of ammo wasting. you know, Rick takes a bunch out. Carl runs for the grocery basket full of baby goods that she brought with her that Glenn and Maggie had compiled. And then I just wrote, this is an interesting parallel, right? Michonne's out, and Herschel, I think, is the one that's like, is she bit once they've gotten the walkers under control? And Rick is checking her, and he goes, nope, it's a gunshot wound. And actually, this is exactly how Morgan and Rick met. Not exactly. No one hit Michonne over the head with a baseball bat. But this, like, it is the same thing where they searched him for... They saw that he had that huge bandage, and they searched him, and they were like, oh, it's a gunshot wound, not a bite.
The last thing that I had for this scene, we see, so they do two shots. The first shot is this, is up close where we see Rick start to pick her up, and they do a very far away shot where he, like picks up, really picks her up. Like, it's hot. It's, like, over his whole shoulder. It's really intense. It's clearly stunt doubles. This is not Andrew Lincoln and Denai Granero doing these, but... it's very hot in this faraway shot. I was like, oh yeah. And I'll just also add that their intensity between every single take, you know, as they're just staring at each other is really hot as well.
I really love Michonne, and I love how we don't, you know, it kind of takes a lot in this early interaction with her to love her because she doesn't give us a lot of, like, text. Yeah. And they go inside and... He, you know, they lay her down, and poor Michonne, though, she, like, wakes up and freaks and goes for her sword immediately, and they, like, kind of have her pinned, and I'm like, oh, what a fucking nightmare. Like, it's just the thing where it's like, yep, everyone is an enemy until they're not anymore. And you came to these people because you were like, well, I need some people because I'm all fucked up. They're still strangers, and strangers don't trust you. But it's like, we're not going to hurt you until you do something stupid is the version of a, like, welcome to our home. Let me show you where the guest towels are. Like, that is the closest we can get to that in this world. And they're very upfront about it, which I kind of appreciate.
I love, I mean, like, it's just they figured out a system that is way clearer than Randall already, which is like, look, we are going to keep you captive, obviously, but we have no intention of hurting you unless you do something that warrants being hurt, because then that makes this choice very easy for us. And it is just a much better communication style in the apocalypse, as opposed to, oh God, we have this guy, now what do we do? And we have three or four different people talking to him in different ways that don't make any sense. I know,
and remember no one told him he was pardoned until T-Dog came to be like, Randall, we're taking you away, like, a full day after they had decided not to kill him and no one told him. Yes, they're being much clearer with their boundaries. They've learned and grown. And then, like, Daryl comes in while all this is happening, is like, who's this? But he's also like, I don't even care. Guys, come.
Come here. You're going to want to see this, he says. And I'm like yes.
Also, this is so wild, though, because he's like, come back here. And Rick is like, everything all right? And Daryl just responds, you're going to want to see this. And it's like, Daryl, the last time you saw this man, he was like wandering around unable to make eye contact with his own children and like really struggling. Do not even give him a moment of thinking everything is not all right. Like, he needs to know everything is all right. You should say, yeah, but you're going to want to see this.
I mean, valid point, but still, like, I had this note, and then I was like, oh my God, he's taking so long to follow Daryl. Go follow Daryl.
I know.
But there's other stuff that happens.
Because he's like, I don't know if it's an all right thing that I want to see. Like, do I want to see this? But then he...
Wait, hold on. This is why we can't leave there yet, because there's just a couple more things that Rick says to Michonne that I think are important.
Yeah, that's what I have too, is like, he... And he still has her sword.
He says the watchword for the season. You're going to be safe here. Clock. It comes up a few more times this episode. It's the whole idea of safe is really played with a lot this season. So he says that, and then they have this exchange about Michonne finally says something, because through this entire thing she hasn't said anything.
I know.
She's just
sorry though. This is the thing I wanted to say about the governor. The difference between Rick and Michonne. Which is, right, one of the things that I like in this moment is Rick takes the sword, and Michonne's face is clearly like, no, 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 don't take the sword. But at least Rick is being super upfront about it. He's like, I'm going to take this, and, you know, we'll give it back to you when you leave. But you can see on her face, she's like, no, fuck, this is exactly the same thing that happened in Woodbury. God damn it. But at least Rick is being super clear of it's not like... for her own good. It's for their safety. He's being super clear about it's for their safety. And then we get this exchange between Michonne and Rick, right? Which is, I think, what you were about to say, right? The first thing she says in this whole episode.
I didn't ask for your help.
I know. And he says, doesn't matter. Can't let you leave. This is where I'm like, this is at least him being upfront about it. It's not like the governor where it's like, well, totally, we're going to let you leave. But the day is not right. The time's not right. Straightforward communication. Maybe he learned that from his telephone friends. and then off they go to see whatever it is that Daryl's found. And I wrote down.
I wonder what it is.
I know, a nice blanket, some awesome slippers that match Oscar's. No, it's Carol. I love it. And Rick's face when he sees her, like, it's like he really doesn't truly understand what he's looking at. Like, it's like he has a moment too of like, is that a walker? Like, is that Walker Carol? Because it can't be real Carol. But it's just for a second. And then he's like, oh my God, it's Carol. Like, she's smiling and she's like banged up, but she's alive.
It is so emotional. And there's very little dialogue during it. But there's just a few things that I clocked. One, we've said this before, but they do love a reunion. This reunion is spectacular.
It is really
Walking
good.
Dead loves a reunion, and they do them very well. The thing that I could not stop watching was Daryl's face. Through most of this, and how happy he is to see Carol back and to see her hugging people and all of these things. And he's just like that thing where he's just like loving watching her get love and hugs. And I'm here for that little smirky on his face. It's great.
I know. Well, and it's clearly why he wasn't just like, guys, I found Carol. Come on. Like, he wanted this moment of them. He wanted her to see like how glad they are to see her. Like, he wanted her to have that, which is why he wasn't just like, guys, amazing news. And they're like, how did this happen? And she just says, solitary. And I just wrote down, I'm glad our country's propensity for solitary confinement, a method of torture under the Geneva Convention. I'm glad that has an upside, which is that Carol had a nice little place to hide out. Prison. Speaking of reunions, we also get a reunion that's like a first union, which is Carol meeting the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like her face when she sees this baby in Beth's arms is just like so really happy. Like, it's like, oh my God, the baby, like the baby is here. And that means it all worked out all right. And like, the baby's here. And then it's like she clocks that's not Lori holding the baby. That's Beth. And Lori is not here. And it's like this look to Rick, wordless, right? This is all wordless. So this like look to Rick, and Rick just like nods to confirm, like, yeah, it didn't. She's gone. And I just think this whole thing is so wet. Like, Melissa McBride does a really beautiful job of going from like incandescent with joy that this baby is here to like, oh my God, my friend is dead. And there's like this, and one of the things I found most like kind of moving is like that Carol just has one, like she has a hand to her mouth, but her other hand is pressing against Rick's chest. Did you see this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like such, like, you know, it's this like tangible point of connection between the two of them. And her hand, like, it's not like it's placed there. It's like she's actively pressing into him. Like it's trying to push a sense of remorse. Like, you know, it's trying to push something that's like too big for words into him. And he is reacting to it a little. He's like kind of crying a little bit. Because also this is the first time he's had to tell anybody that Lori's dead. Everyone else found out the same time he did or a little sooner.
Yeah, he cries and she clocks. Carol also clocks Carl's face in this moment. And like, and there's that because it all of a sudden becomes, it's that I wrote in my notes that it becomes real for both Carl and Rick. I think to your point, because they had to tell somebody. Hmm. Like these people were already here. It was discovered. They knew it, but now it's like it just becomes all real again. And it also only happened like 48 hours ago. And we see that Michonne is watching them this entire time too.
And I'm like, you know, and like, thank God she is, right? Because this is something that like she can, this is evidence, right? Because this shows, this is like the first indication that it's like, okay, maybe I didn't just like stumble into Woodbury 2.0. They're more her people, right, than the people in Woodbury in terms of how they've lived up to this point, like that there's like loss involved and stuff like that.
For Michonne trying to decide if she's going to work with these people, mm-hmm. it really was about, like, what are they going to show me? And Woodbury tries really hard not to show anybody anything by saying it's showing you everything, right? Mm-hmm. And here's a situation in which she is seeing firsthand, like, the care and the love that they have, but also, yeah, as you said, the loss. And Woodbury was so put together that it wouldn't even let you experience loss in that way, right? The loss was about other people who didn't make it because they didn't have us, right? That was the loss that Woodbury experienced while she was there. But these are people who have actually lost things and are fighting for them. And so for me, yeah, I just love this moment so much because I'm like, I think this is when she decides that she'll speak a little bit more.
And we go from this moment in like this dirty little prison, like to Woodbury, ah yes, that peaceful, idyllic town where kids ride their bikes up and down the main street while Glenn is tortured in a secret prison underneath their feet. Like, it's like the prison looks like shit and super scary, but at least the people in it are, like, very straightforward. And then we have Woodbury that's pretending that everything is amazing and then has all this secret shit happening in all these different places. And not even that the, like, Mr. Coleman shit is, like, a bad kind of thing that's happening, but it's like, why are there all these secret little cubby holes with experiments happening that no one knows about?
I agree. I'll just say that in my notes, I called it Woodbury, the land of the bangs, because we are coming up on the governor and Andrea post-banging, thinking about banging again and doing a little bit of a, you know, interplay in this moment. It takes a minute to get there because Milton interrupts it, but you know.
Yeah, but like what a long day for Andrea and the governor too. They were drinking whiskey earlier, Meeker. It's whiskey day still. And that bathrobe he's wearing is the same bathrobe from when he was talking to Merle. So like what? Merle left 45 minutes ago to go fuck with Glenn, and then Milton shows up and is like, Mr. Coleman is dying. And I bet the governor is just like, man, being in charge is so hard because things just are always happening. And then we get like this, whatever, Andrea, I'll be back.
Yeah, well, and this whole thing too that I just dislike so much, the I need your help with something. And then she immediately like reaches for his crotch and he's like, I wish it were just that, as if this is going to be the most burdensome ask he's ever had of her. And it's not. It's this dumb experiment thing that we will talk about.
I know.
When we get there.
I do think, I thought he was sending Andrea there like almost entirely just to keep her in a weird cubby hole somewhere in Woodbury that is presumably not very close to where they're keeping Maggie and Glenn. Like, I don't know that he was like, oh my God, Andrea, you're the only person I can trust with this, because her job is literally nothing. But I do think he wants her out of the way.
Yeah, I think so. I think he wants somebody not paying attention to where he is all day, for sure.
But yeah, off Andrea goes for that, I guess. Whatever. We don't know what that experiment is, but Yeah, and then we're back at the prison, and I'm like, thank goodness, because I don't want any more of that Andrea Governor shit. And it's Michonne, right? And Rick is kind of reiterating his whole thing of, like, we'll help you, but only in exchange for you telling us how the fuck you found us and why you had formula. And
I think I think they're, honestly, considering she's a captive, like, they're being pretty reasonable.
Oh, totally.
They are being intense, but it's a different kind of intense.
Yeah. Well, it is the interesting thing where Herschel is present in this scene, too, because at some point, and I appreciate that they did this off screen, right? But at some point, they've realized, well, this woman showed up with a bucket of baby supplies. The only people who know we have a baby are in this prison, except for Glenn and Maggie, who are not back yet, right? And Michonne says, well, I picked up the baby formula because it was dropped by, you know, an Asian guy and a pretty girl. And Herschel is immediately, like, up on his foot. Like, what happened to them? Ugh, poor Herschel. Like, Herschel's really intent in this moment. And so is Rick. But Rick is, I just wrote down, Rick's not good cop anymore. Because the way Rick decides to get this information is he goes straight for Michonne's wound and, like, pushes it. And Michonne freaks out, justifiably, and is like, don't touch me.
Well, let's note, too, that her wound is on her upper thigh.
Yes,
so
it's not a good place for touching regardless.
Yeah, it's not a good... It's not a good, and especially if you're coming from a place like Woodbury, as we're about to see, where she more than likely felt an energy from the governor most of the time about, you know, just that kind of vibe. I understand why she's
so
protective. That's
bad news there. It's bad news there for everybody.
And it's the only part, honestly, of this entire interrogation that I'm a little bit like, Rick, please don't do that. Like, it makes me really uncomfortable that you did that. But also, like, this, I mean, I don't think that we're meant to think that this is unreasonable. So I know why he does it.
It's just the thing where it's like, but Rick, Michonne is also a person. Unfortunately, you don't know that yet. We do. We've been watching her for 7 episodes, but you don't. And so you're treating her like she is the nameless guy that you throw to walkers later in the episode. And she's not. She's a person. that guy was a person too, but oh well. And Daryl also, the second that Michonne starts to freak out, Daryl is backup guy. He has his crossbow up and he starts saying, like, you better start talking or you're going to have a much bigger problem than a gunshot wound. And this is a moment for me where, like, Michonne, I don't think we have enough on screen to show us this, but this is a moment where I was like, does Michonne know that's Daryl? This is the one. That's Marl's brother. Clocked it. Figured it out. It's this one with the crossbow.
I don't know.
Because I guess I'm curious, how much of a blabbermouth was Andrea in terms of, did Andrea tell the story of the time she almost murdered a man in cold blood through her shoddy marksmanship? Which that I don't think we have, like, evidence to support that. But we do know that Merle has been desperate to find Andrea's people because his brother is with them. And it's the question for me, too, of, like, how much of, and it's hard because she didn't talk in the last episode, right? But it's hard to say how much of that she picked up from Merle and Glenn's exchange of him being like, where's my brother? Because that is the moment where she's like, find them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Is like immediately after that exchange with Daryl. That's why I'm curious, because I don't actually think she would schlep all the way here if she didn't want them to go to Woodbury. And I don't know that she wants them to go for Glenn and Maggie. I think she wants them to go to fuck with Woodbury. And so that she can maybe get Andrea, potentially. And at the very least, get her revenge.
I think you're making all good points. I hadn't clocked it that way. But also, we get so little of what Andrea and Michonne know about each other that I just don't know. I don't have enough information. But it would make sense. And Danai is certainly acting very much like, yeah, I'm sizing this guy up who's got the crossbow to me. Yes.
Here's the other interesting thing is she doesn't actually say Merle's name this whole time. And she doesn't mention Andrea either. And I can understand not mentioning Andrea. But the Merle thing seems a little less clear because she does refer to him as like the son of a bitch who shot me. And that's not like invalid reconnaissance information. Is like, okay, who are the people we need to be watching out for? And she's just like paramilitary wannabes. They're headed by a man named Merle. He's a dick. He doesn't have a hand and he just tried to fucking kill me. So I think the lack of spilling all implies to me that she, like, has put, like, maybe some things together, but it's not in her best interest to reveal them.
I think you're right. Yeah. All the things you just said, I think, have convinced me that she's making a calculated move in this moment to not reveal all the things that she knows about these people because she's Yeah, she certainly would have known who, like, just based on Andrea's love of them, more than likely, she would have heard stories about each of these people. So she now knows where she is.
So I just think she's, like, really aware that this is complicated and she's doing a really good job of navigating it. Rick makes the good point, you came here for a reason, so, like, you're going to talk, because why else would you come here? And then mm-hmm. she starts describing, she's like, they're in Woodbury. They're led by, like, I wrote it down, pretty boy, charming, Jim Jones type. And I just was like, yes, Michonne, we agree.
No, she says that I wrote down the Jim Jones type too, being like, yes, we've been talking about it all season.
And yeah, Rick is then like, okay, our man Herschel will like heal you up. That's his daughter who's in Woodbury. And off he goes to like start setting up a plan. And I just wrote, man, Rick couldn't have an easy first day back at work. He had to dive straight into the deep end. But also, how many days off of work has he taken? Maybe one since his wife died. It's really, we're back on crazy time.
Well, and also, are there days off when you're in a zombie apocalypse?
I know. But like, we had some days off in between, or we had some days off camera rather, in between Herschel first getting his leg amputated and then being well enough to like start crutching around the prison. Mm-hmm. But now we're back to like every episode takes up where the last one leaves off, and thus everything is happening in one day.
I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Now and Then.
No, I have not.
Oh my God, you would love this movie because it's, you know, these girls and they've grown up. Oh, yeah. It wasn't that. It was a different Christina Ricci movie. Sorry, rewind. Right? So have you seen Opposite of Sex?
No.
So she's the narrator through the whole thing, and she's like supposed to be in high school, but she's Christina Ricci, so she is not in high school. But she talks about like in the very first section of the movie, her narration is like, just so you know, this is not about growing and changing. I will not wistfully say at the end of the story that I never was the same after that summer, right? Like, it's like, that's not the story. And it's actually like her, like an opening where she's screaming at her dead stepfather and ruining his funeral and like pouring out whiskey and stuff like in his grave. Like,
fantastic.
Right. And then the end of the movie, of course, she did grow and change because people like to see people grow and change. And so her final line is just like, OK, fine. I never was again the same after that summer. And I fucking love it. She was also in Now and Then, which is what made me think of it. But that's like, for me, the Walking Dead timeline is always like, I never was the same after that week. Like, that's what it feels like for me.
But it's like every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Life changing. I think we're shooting the shit about this because the next thing we're going back to is Merle torturing Glenn.
And I hate it. I hate it. I hate it so much. I hate it so much.
I know. I just wrote down, this is where I stopped. I think this is actually where I stopped in the first iteration. I don't like it when Glenn gets hurt. Merle says, you're a lot tougher than I remember. And I'm just like, fuck you, Merle. What the fuck? Fuck you. Like,
yeah, I mean, I, and we don't have
almost
to
almost admiringly, and it's like, Merle, that's a fucked up way to like believe in someone. You could just believe in him.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, like, my first note at the top of the scene is like, Glenn's not doing well. He looks destroyed already, and the camera
half
is really showing
is
that
just lumps.
And that's too when like Merle starts to not only do the physical onslaught but the psychological one, right? Where he's basically trying to talk about how these people are all abandoners because he has the information from Andrea, and so he feels like he can prey on that with Glenn a little bit about how everybody how this group abandons people.
Yeah. Well, and he doesn't even need the information from Andrea. He's like, they left me to rot on that roof. And he's talking a lot of shit about Rick, and I just, like, sweet, precious Glenn. You know, Merle lets loose all this torrent of, like, they're not coming for you, and Rick, blah, 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 blah. And Glenn immediately is just like, it's just a matter of time until he comes looking. Merle's response, I'll bake a cake with pink frosting.
Love that line.
I know, it is a good line. I love Glenn's touching faith in Rick, a man who he last saw losing his marbles all over the basement. But I do think part of it is, like, he does have that faith in Rick, but also it's part of the bluff, right? It's him being like, Rick is coming with an army. There's too many of us. You can't take us on. Rick is the most sane man in the world, and he's going to kill you dead. Like, it's very that front, and it could work. But he mentions a bunch of people that Merle knows from Andrea are not dead, especially since Andrea herself is not dead, and she's the one that Glenn ends the list with. And it's just like,
Well, I wrote down, because the list of the dead is actually really interesting, because it's not everybody. It's just the men and Andrea. So yeah. It's Shane and Jim and T-Dog, or not T-Dog.
Shane, Jim, Dale, who I'm Dale. Like, Dale is going to be part of the Avenging Army in his fisherman hat.
Yeah. And then it's Andrea. And so I thought that was interesting, because for Glenn, he was like, I need to scare Merle into thinking that we have more muscle than he has. So this is who we have. And so it is interesting to me that Glenn put, because he doesn't say Jackie in that list, right? Like,
no. Although I am curious about if it just stops with Andrea because Merle reacts the most after Andrea. Like, I am curious if he was going to keep going on and be like, you know, Morales, that other person that we saw in the background folding laundry that one time, Ed. Like, you know, is he just going to name every person he's ever seen? Like,
yeah,
in hopes maybe of sparing Merle.
The last thing that I had for this scene, because the list of the dead, I think, is close to the end,
is that it also in the scene, for me anyway, it made it seem like Glenn thought that maybe Merle was just a man alone. Inside, because he says something about like, you know, we haven't been hiding out in a dungeon,
yeah,
sort of implying that like where they are, it feels like, oh, this is just Merle hiding out and it's just him on his own. And he doesn't have anybody behind him. So I'm just going to scare him with these numbers. But Merle also wants it to be made clear to Glenn that he's not alone. He's got a team here too. You just don't see it. And also Merle is being very careful about not giving that information fully, but implying it.
Yeah. But yeah, I certainly, Glenn doesn't have a full understanding of what Woodbury is, or he would never try the bluff. There's too many of us for a town of 75, right? But yeah, and it ends with, you know, Glenn, you know, running through this list and Merle going like, oh, really? And just looking so fucking satisfied with himself. And I'm just like, ugh!
And that's when Margot covers her eyes and doesn't watch the rest of the episode.
Yeah, pretty much. No, I can watch the next scene, Herschel's first aid station. Man, they're lucky Herschel can do stitches. Like, it is almost like, what if at the end of The Walking Dead, actually the big reveal was that none of this had happened at all and it was just a D&D campaign? Because they were very clear of like, okay, we need like a ranger, we need a medic, we need, like, you know, like, they're like, we really got to shore up some holes in our party.
For sure, Herschel's a paladin, right? Yeah. Like, he has to be, or a cleric or something.
But he's a healer, and Rick can be. I don't know what Rick is. Paladin and his goddess's safety. But yeah, they're very lucky Herschel can do stitches, and he is stitching Michonne. And Michonne is super wary, but I do, like, you know, it is very interesting that, like, and I don't know how, I don't think it's necessarily super intentional. Like, these are just maybe the things that are done when you bring people into a place. But it is interesting that we're hitting kind of the same beats as her entry into Woodbury, right? And now we're at the medic stop. And the last medic she saw was super like, I'm not authorized to tell you that. Like, you'll have to wait for someone with more seniority. Like, I can't confirm or deny where you are. Like, and at least Herschel is like a normal dude. Like, and he's a dad. He's like a dad who's scared that his kid is, you know, gone. And then Carl is also there.
With his hand hovering over his gun the entire time.
I think he appointed himself to be in charge of protecting Herschel, and so his hand keeps twitching near the gun. And Michonne tracks that, and she tracks, you know, Herschel providing care for her, too. And she does thank him, right?
She
is a step up from the medic at Woodbury, where I think they were just like, what the fuck is happening? Like,
oh, no, and just that while they're patching up Michonne, the others are meeting and convening about what to do about Glenn and Maggie.
Yeah,
and I just have to say, before we dig into it, Beth is the cutest. Beth is like, I'm going to go save my sister. And of course, you don't see her do that, but I find that so charming.
I know.
She's like, I'll go.
She doesn't end up going, but she does volunteer. And I do like that the person who opens this scene is Oscar, who's like, how do we know we can trust her? And it's like, oh, Oscar, remember yesterday when they didn't trust you? And Axel volunteers to go too. Axel's like, I'll go. And like, clearly everyone's like, Beth and Axel, excellent thought. Really wonderful effort. You can stay here. it's interesting to track, right? This is not the dictatorship of earlier, of like taking the prison. It's a little bit more of a back and forth, this conversation, but Rick is definitely still in charge of like the final decision, right? They're appealing to Rick about it. Just interesting to track how like his, you know, telephone hour in the basement has maybe shifted some of those dynamics. They figure out the, you know, the final squad, final team that's going, and it's Daryl, Oscar, Michonne, and Rick. And I just wrote down, Daryl wasn't a Boy Scout, but he should have been because they're loading up the car and he has the flashbangs and the tear gas and ends his, and he's putting them in the trunk. And then he ends with, never know what you might need.
Always be prepared, says the Boy Scouts.
I know. That's actually what we... how we can tell Daryl wasn't a Boy Scout. He doesn't know always be prepared. He just always is prepared. And so he says, you never know what you might need. And he also has this very sweet moment with Carl at the car where he like turns to Carl and he's like, don't worry about your old man. I'm going to keep an eye on him. Hearts.
It's really good. He's such a good dad.
I love it so much.
And then like, as they're all loading up, right? Michonne is talking about like to Beth, right? Like, you cleared this prison. Like, I thought this place was overrun. You guys did this all by yourself. And she clearly doesn't believe that it happened. And like, she ends with that phrase, right? All by yourself. And Beth just responds very simply, there were others.
I also just really enjoyed that moment because for me, just to, as you were sort of pointing out the differences between Rick's group and Woodbury, like, they are telling her everything that she's asking. They're not withholding, and they're speaking in a way that Michonne understands because she's also been on the road and she's also had to fight for everything versus the Woodbury people who are so close-lipped about everything while saying that they're not, because for them, secrets are power. And for people who've actually been on the road, it's like, no, more information is going to make it so that we can get out of here alive. Anyway, I appreciated that moment as well, yeah. Especially because she's technically a captive, but she's not really at all. And it's clear in this moment.
No, she's going to leave with them and lead them to Woodbury as part of the attack team. I know. And then we have this Rick and Carl heart to heart where I'm like, I don't know that this is my favorite parenting. Like, I think it's the best they can all do. But I'm like, uh-oh. Mostly because, right, there's this moment of like Rick trying to address what Carl did for Lori, right? And Carl's immediately like, I had to, like a little defensively, right? Like he thinks Rick is going to be mad at him for that. And Rick's like, no, I'm not mad. Like, I know, I'm sorry. No one should have to do that. And that I'm okay with. These are like the little baby steps of like sort of rebuilding trust with Carl because he kind of just dropped the ball with Carl a little bit. But then It's the next part in the scene where I'm like, this is a really unhealthy amount of weight to put on your child. Is him being like, okay, so if something happens and we don't get back, like, you know, if something happens, you have to take care of these people and like put them in the cells. And like, that is a really heavy weight to put on a kid, especially a kid who has taken a lot of very heavy weights onto his little shoulders. But it's like their shared sense of responsibility, right, is in some ways their like strongest bond. And so Rick's appealing to it, but I don't think it's healthy.
I don't disagree at all. I found it really weird. But also, this is the problem sometimes that I have with their dynamic, is I can't ever tell when he's like giving Carl lip service of being in charge of like, because yeah. Like really what's going to happen is Herschel's going to take control, right?
Sure. But here's the thing. Obviously, Herschel's going to take control. He also physically cannot do some of the things Carl can do that we just saw him do very well at the beginning of the episode of like running and shooting. And the fact that they're not going to leave Axel in charge and Carol is dehydrated and Beth is 16 and the baby is a baby. You know, I don't know that he actually is like, it's all on you, Carl. And if something goes down, you're responsible for that. I don't think that's the intention behind it, but I don't think it's quite like just him being like, you're the man of the house.
Yeah.
Go help Herschel with dinner as the man of the house. Like, you know, there's real stakes here. And I think, I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think they're both kind of not sure how far those stakes go.
And then, of course, we get this wonderful conversation about what we're going to name the baby, which I actually really do like. You know, Carl says, Daryl has been calling her ass kicker, and Rick is delighted by that. And so are we all.
I mean, I'm delighted by it. And I do think it's funny that Rick, like, simultaneously seems to think it's funny, but also is like, what? He's named my child Ass Kicker? Like, you know, there's like an intonation there. That's clearly him being like, that's a terrible name. And this is an appropriate amount of responsibility to give like a 12-year-old. You're in charge of naming the baby, Carl. What should we name the baby?
And he favorite part of this, though, is that Carl is like, hey, do you remember my third grade teacher? And Rick says, yes. And I'm like, no, you don't, Rick. Do not lie to that boy.
But it wasn't like, even just yes. It was something like, of course, or like, definitely. Yeah. Like, you know, it was something a little more intense than yes. And it's like, well, here's the thing. It's either no, he definitely doesn't, or there was something that happened that Rick is like, yes, I do remember that teacher.
Yeah, she did not like you, and she called me into for a parent teacher conference. No,
like, that was the year you kept getting into like that the boy was picking on you, and the teacher was in contact with us constantly. Like,
yeah, the only names of teachers that my parents remember are the ones that called them into offices to have conferences about me, and even still, it had to be repeat offenses. So they remember my elementary school principal's name because I was a repeat offender in elementary school, but they don't remember a lot of my middle school teachers or my high school teachers at all, because why would they? But I do love that Rick is like, of course I remember that third grade teacher, sure, and then Carl's like, well, her name was Judith. And he's like, okay, great. Okay. Well, if I don't remember her, all the better, because I won't have any like feelings about her.
I like how far Carl has come in this, that he's just like, I mean, and odds are Mrs. Mueller is probably also dead. Like, RIP Mrs. Mueller, we barely knew ye. But I do appreciate that Carl's not like, and I've decided we should name her like Sophia Lauren. Like, you know, like, no. Don't do that. It's not a tribute name. It's just a like, this was a name of a person I liked. And I wonder if part of it is that like Carol was one of the names that he offered, and Carol's not dead. So they picked Judith. Yeah. Like,
Judith is a great name. A I love name. The name Judith. And we might have spoiled it already on accident. I apologize if we did.
I mean, I know I did last week, but I also then yelled, it's a spoiler. So we'll see if you remembered to cut it out or not.
Yes.
That sounded like a slur on your editing. It's not, because you edit all of them and I do nothing.
It's not a slur on my editing. I'm fine. Oh no, I was about to take us there too, but you can tell because it's okay. Well, it is perhaps one of my favorite things. Another moment of safe, by the way. We had some in the Rick and Carl scene, and now we have my favorite moment of safe, which is Daryl approaching Carol holding little ass kicker Judith.
Yeah.
And he says to her, with all the warmth and compassion and fucking that mouth, it's just great. He's like, stay safe. And she says, you say it, Margo.
Nine lives, remember? Hearts. I love it so much. Well, and part of what I love about it is that this is like a callback to a private joke that we have not seen on camera, right? I like that we're like layering in the same way that like that scene on top of the bus in the first episode of the season. It's like just showing us more and more the depths of how their relationship has like grown on the road. And I really appreciate that. And that's also where the name of that fanfiction website that only has Carol and Daryl fanfiction on it comes from, because it's called.
I'm sure there are a number of fanfictions that talk about the genesis of this inside joke. However, I would like those.
Mm, I know. And then they all sort of like set off. And Herschel's last line to them is, bring them back. And like, how hard for these people to be the ones left behind waiting as the others set off on a rescue mission for people that have been kidnapped by a hostile force. And they don't know how successful they're going to be in getting not only those people back, but in getting back themselves, right? It's like very like, what happens to these people if they're the ones left standing? And it's, you know, it's an elderly man, one woman, one teenage girl, one child, and Axel, who is not in this like leave-taking scene. I don't know where he is.
No, he's at the bottom fence. So they're all at the top fences, and he's at the bottom fence.
Yeah, so he is there. But it's like, this is the last group. What happens if they are the only ones left is like not enjoyable. But they hop in the car and they drive away. And my final note is, gosh, Georgia is beautiful, even in prison. They take off down like a beautifully leafy, wooded road.
And then we go to this record playing, this old-timey music, and we know it's old-timey because it's on a record, and also because it has that plinky-plinky sound. And that's what I wrote in my notes.
Thank yes, you, thank that, you. All of that's true. Yeah, we go from like people prepping for war to like this old man's deathbed and gentle music playing and soothing paintings on the walls. Although I did laugh, there's like these paintings hung up and then also like some half, you know, those anatomy figures that are like cut open so you can see the inside of them. There's one of those in the background of one of the, like behind one of the paintings. In a way that's very like, well, Milton couldn't fix all of the problems, but he sure tried. And Andrea's clearly like, what the fuck is this? As the governor leads her into this room, because it's just like, it's weird. And Milton's there and he's feeding the man soup. And I just wrote, why isn't it tea? Milton's tea is great.
But it's also highly suspicious it's constantly.
It's highly suspicious. And Milton's behavior towards the old man is not that suspicious. And the governor is like super intent with this old man. And he's being like, thank you for this. You're doing us a great service. And like, Andrea, but the governor hasn't explained anything. He's just taken her to this secret room filled with like classical music, soothing paintings, and a dying man in a bed. Cause the guy doesn't look good. It's not like Milton is feeding him soup for shits and giggles. Like he can't hold a spoon. And Andrea's like kind of a little weirded out where it's like, what? Service, like, what are you talking about? What's happening here? And the governor just leaves.
Yeah, this is again, I just get super annoyed. He is like the least forthcoming with information, and she finds it charming. And I'm just like, how? And this is like, this is manipulative bullshit.
Like, why is he keeping this a secret? Milton is going to tell her in 3 seconds. Like, there's no reason not to just tell her now, or tell her on the walk, or tell her when you're putting pants on and taking off your plaid robe. It's like he just loves to keep a secret for the purpose of keeping a secret.
And Milton asks for Andrea to put the record back onto the first song, and then he does this thing with the, are they called like meditation bowls or?
Yeah. It's one of those. It's like one of those that you hit and then it vibrates and then you circle and do some stuff with it.
I mean, and, it's a meditative tone, right? It's like a really clear tone. There's not like a.
Yeah.
It's an intentional tone. It's not one that just occurs randomly. And he essentially explains to Andrea, right, that, like, this is the experiment, is that, like, this man is dying. And they...
He doesn't in this scene. We are only thrown into the ritual of the questions in this scene.
Oh, yes, that's true. Okay, so...
And so we're still trying to figure it out, like, by the time we get to the next scene. But, like, yeah, so, like he does the bowl thing, and he, like, shows pictures to Mr. Coleman on the bed.
Yeah, he's like, my name is Milton Mamet. Raise your hand if this is your name, like Michael Coleman or whatever. Raise your hand. Like, here's a picture of you were married to this woman, and he holds up a picture. This was your daughter, like, and he raises his hand for all of these things. And then he reaches out and, like, touches Milton's hand at the end of it. In a way that it's kind of like, what a hard way to spend your last months on Earth is to be, like, sick and just doing this with Milton in, like, a secret room, you know? Yeah. And that it does seem pretty clear that, like, him and Milton have a good relationship. He, like, reaches out and, like, touches Milton's hand and asks for him to let the music play. And we go
from there. And Andrea is still just like, what the fuck is going on? And Andrea's
like, what?
Then we go from that into a really more terrifying Glenn.
No, that's bad. Yeah, it's terrible. It's like Glenn is on he's duct taped to that chair. Merle comes in with a new friend. Spoilers, it's not a friend, it's a walker with all its teeth. But he's like wrangling it like the ones that they use for the fights. And Merle is like talking some psychological mind game shit of like, imagine how I felt fighting my way off this roof. See how you like it, and like throws this walker at Glenn and urges it on with like a go run, boy. And it's like so like, what? Like, I mean, it is so short-sighted too. And I think Martinez talks about this later in the episode too, which is like, he's leverage. Why did you try and kill him? Like, I don't know why Merle does this, except that he's mad and annoyed and he doesn't like what's happening. And so he's like, got a temper, and he does this thing.
I don't want to give Merle a charitable read at all. But he didn't want to do this to Maggie.
Maybe. But then what happens when, like, he's killing leverage for Maggie, too. Like, he hasn't, if Glenn dies, then that's leverage he can't use on Maggie. And that's another tool he can't use on Maggie, which means that, like, he's that much closer to having to do this to Maggie. Like, it's just bad planning all around.
Yeah, the killing of Glenn is still very, very, very short-sighted. I just meant that, like, I think, like, basically what happened is that he spent too much time with Glenn, and therefore Glenn got him mad because Glenn wasn't going to give up any of the information. And ultimately, Merle does want his brother back. yeah, I think he just got super mad and didn't think any of this through.
Yeah, no, I think he just has an anger problem and he just wanted to hurt Glenn because it doesn't serve Merle at all, except that he's frustrated. Like, it doesn't get him actually anything he wants. Because I don't genuinely think he's like, well, I think Glenn can take him duct tape to a chair. Doesn't seem to be a thing. But guess what? Glenn can take him, even duct tape to a chair.
Ugh, he's so good and he's so smart in this fight.
I know, he's so really smart. And lucky him, the dungeon is full of really weird old shit, like wire bed frames and things like that to use to delay a very hungry walker. And Glenn is able to sort of like stumble away from him until he smashes the chair and then uses the chair leg to kill the walker. It's very smart fighting, but also he kills this walker and then he just stands there and screams because what the fuck? And like the adrenaline at that moment must have been just like so intense and he just screams. And I am curious of like, it seems like Maggie is in the same location in the later scene as she was in the earlier scene, right? So we have to assume that Maggie heard all of this and it's like, what does she think is happening?
I was really terrified the first time I watched it that they were going to kill Glenn. It's a very well done fight. He's very smart, but it's really difficult to watch this episode for these particular reasons, which is why we're having so much fun in Milton's experimental room where everything is weird in a way that is just weird and therefore we can accept it.
So this is when Milton explains the experiment, which is essentially him trying to see like, right, do walkers remember things? So I've like created all of these really tactile or not tactile, but very tangible things that the music, the bowl, like that can like hopefully the questions that hopefully there'll be enough retention of that kind of ritual that the walker will respond to it, even if, it doesn't have like conscious thought anymore. Subconsciously, it'll respond. And then Andrea's only job is Milton is going to see what the walker remembers. And then Andrea is on call to kill him when the experiment is over. Like, that's it. Literally anyone could do that job. Like, except Milton. Milton couldn't do that job. But yeah, and this is part of the moment, right, where it's like he's talking about Coleman and Milton says he's been very cooperative. He's a remarkable man. And it's like, yeah, they've actually spent time, like how hard and weird and...
Well, and two, just to, because we are so focused on Andrea this season, you know, Milton is certain that there's a trace of the mm-hmm. person behind. And Andrea is certain that's not true because of Amy. And
I think it's not only because of Amy. I think it actually is a similar problem to what we saw last season with Herschel, right? Where Rick was like really very intently trying to explain, like, there's nothing there. They're gone. They're not coming back. And part of that was because they watched this whole CDC presentation from Jenner showing the brain die. So I do think it's the same thing here where it's like the people who were at the CDC have this kind of like authoritative explanation for what happens. And they really believe it. I do think the Amy thing is like very forward in her mind about it. I think that's like also her thing is that like, well, because obviously if anyone could have retained memory, it would have been my sister and then she wouldn't have tried to eat me.
I think, yeah, for me, it becomes about Amy later in the episode.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, that's it for me later too. And I also just am like, because this is the moment, right, where we learn that Milton has never seen anyone die and come back as a walker, which is also just like a really good way of a very tragic reveal, which is essentially that Milton has never had friends. And Milton hasn't seen anyone die in the apocalypse because he was an orphan who worked from home. I felt a lot of sympathy because that's actually the way that our pandemic apocalypse happened, was with everyone home alone. And so I actually was like, yeah, Milton, it is very lonely and like scary and isolating.
I actually really, this, even though I think this experiment is silly and dumb, I really do like Milton. It makes me understand a lot about Milton that he wants this to be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really does.
But the scene ends with them tying down Mr. Coleman.
Yeah, right. Well, and it's interesting because he passes right after this reveal that Milton is an orphan who worked from home and so has never seen anyone die. And it's like before that turns into an even more vulnerable conversation, Mr. Coleman dies. Like, time to stop talking and focus on the experiment, and they lock him up. Milton's little hands are very shaky. You know who sucks? It's my transition.
I was trying to figure out a way to transition to this next scene and nothing came to me. So I think you know who sucks is a great transition.
You know who sucks? It's the governor. And it is interesting because like Merle is kind of talking through some of this stuff with Glenn and the Andrea problem and like stuff like that. And I mean, this is the thing too for me where it's like, he is super displeased with this turn of events because it's not good for him to have Merle or Andrea have connections to someone who is not him. He only trusts the people who can rely on him. He is the only family system. If he's not, his town doesn't work. And so these people cannot be here.
And this is too where Martinez calls Merle out for doing the dumb thing about trying to kill Glenn, because he's like, well, first of all, he handled himself really well in that fight.
He's impressed with Glenn. He's like on board with Glenn.
I think he's a little bit like, I mean, this person would have been useful for us for a number of reasons if he can handle himself tied to a chair. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, of course we'll need him for leverage. What did you try to kill him for? And that's when Merle said he pissed me off.
No.
As if that's an answer. And then the only other thing that I have written for this scene is that, oh, the governor is skipping off to go talk to Maggie.
I know.
And I hate it.
Well, and it is really fascinating though that the governor is like, so what about the girl? And I think Merle is like, I haven't talk to her yet. And the governor is like, I'll take care of it. And I think I'm trying to think of it like as a blank slate for viewers. I wonder if part of us, if it is meant to be a thing where we're meant to be like, oh good, because Merle is off the walls violent and I don't want him near her. And we don't understand yet just how much worse this option is. But Merle kind of does seem to, because he doesn't actually look happy with that. I mean, I just hate this scene. I think it's like, well done, question mark. I don't know. It's very upsetting, which is, I'm sure, the intention behind it. So, like, good job upsetting me. But, you know, leading out of the previous scene, I do think that, like, we are meant to think when he walks in here that this is the better option, and he is so, so much worse. And he's scary from the second he walks in. He has his stupid knife out and, like, goes over to Maggie and, like, cuts her the duct tape holding her wrists, and like her face when he's behind her with this knife is already like so terrified. But like, good Maggie, like, you know, Maggie is like so fucking tough in this scene. And I wrote this a little bit in the later scene, and it's the thing where it's like, if Maggie or Glenn were by themselves, they would never waver, right? They both have like some kind of very real like, you know, there's like a moral core there where they are just like, I'm going to stick with this and I'm not going to let anybody get hurt. And it's complicated by the fact that, like, unfortunately, they're not alone. They're together. And so the only way to really hurt them, they brought with them their one weakness, and the people watching them know it.
The thing for me about this scene in particular, because I agree with everything you're saying about Glenn and Maggie, and that they would never... If the other wasn't there, then this would have all gone down very differently. But what I found so interesting, based too on this thing that you said about the governor being like, oh, maybe as first time viewers, we're like, oh, good, like this is hopefully this person is reasonable as compared to Merle. But the entire scene is shot like a misdirect, right? Because the governor comes in with the knife, and it's like, oh my god, he's gonna do something scary with the knife. Oh no, he cuts her ropes. Okay,
cut the ropes.
And so then.
And he's immediately playing good cop, right? He's really acting like the gentleman of like, oh, may I sit down and let me...
Exactly.
You know, I can... Well, this was all such a huge misunderstanding. Just tell us where your people are and we'll bring you back to them with our apologies. Like, we're so sorry about this. And it's like, she knows, right? She's like, fuck, she knows right away this is fucking bullshit. And she's not going to break. Sass is... not the right word for it, but it's very like arms crossed, like, I don't know anything about that. Like, I'm not gonna give you fucking shit, you monster. Like, she is so steady. And the governor seems like actually kind of pleased that she doesn't waver. And he ends that little beat of that interrogation with like, oh, well, guess we'll have to try something else. Like, he would have been disappointed if she had like flipped right away, because then he wouldn't get to like fucking torture her.
I mean, the only other thing that I wanted to flag from that chunk is he does say to her,
you'll be safe. Mm-hmm. I promise.
Yeah.
I hate it.
But then just to like continue the fake out. So there was the may I sit. And then there is this assault scene, which is constantly sort of subverting and twisting what you think is going to happen in a way that is effective for horror and is very upsetting as a viewer.
But it's, you know, like it's a
stand up and take off your shirt. No, keep going. Right. And so we're like, oh God, this is going to go exactly in our worst case scenario brain. Like it's going to end in like a huge, like, I mean, honestly, the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, this is going to end in a violent rape and I do not want to watch that. But then it's just continuing to twist and to make that tension even worse. You know, the governor takes off his belt. He smells her hair in a way that just makes you be like, oh God, please get out of her hair, get out of her hair. And then out of nowhere, he is violent, but he's violent without necessarily like bruising her, because he pushes her down onto the table and he's trying to get her to talk. He's trying to get her to talk and he's just pressing himself into her. It's very gross. It's very terrible. We don't like it. Lauren Cohen, we are on her face the entire time though. Yeah. And I think that's helpful. That's helpful for these types of scenes, because it's not putting us necessarily in a place of like of turning her into object, but of actually like, okay, no, this is somebody who's experiencing this. And then she says the line that I fucking love, but I hate that it's here, which is do whatever you're going to do.
No, it's you can do whatever you're going to do and go to hell.
Exactly.
Like, you know, fuck you.
But then he doesn't do anything. Well, he does what he's done, which is all awful. But like, again, just in this idea of like, this is a scene that's about subverting and twisting the tension. And it did that very effectively by like not doing what you expected it was going to do.
Well, and it's like, the thing is, he's actually playing a long game here, where in the same way that it would have actually been disappointing for him too, if he had walked in and she'd been like, oh, I'll give it up, it's the prison. Like, that would have been disappointing because he wouldn't have had the opportunity to do this sexual violence. He knows he has time, and so he's not going to then do. Like, that this is part of the fun, is this tension and this, like, causing this off-kilter, like, not knowing what's coming next and doing the thing and then stopping and backing up, or doing this thing and then, you know, it's keeping her off balance. And he's like, because when he lets her go off the table and he like backs up, it's like he's playing with her. It's like it's a game to him, and it's so fucked up. And I think we'll talk probably a little more in the next episode about why this is here and like why they use the whatever, like what is the function of using like sexual violence to forward plot. A great conversation to have, but more later.
It is. And it's definitely questionable.
It's the thing where, like, actually none of this needs to happen this way, except that they want us to feel bad. Like, it could be equally as effective to do something physically violent here, and we would also have been very upset. But there's an idea that they're going for, like, the most upsetting thing, and the most upsetting thing is, like, this. Because, like, it's interesting, too, because Merle does a lot of similar actions physically with Glenn in that first, like, scene, but he does them with his knife. You know, he's tracing Glenn's face with his knife in a way that if it were a human hand, it would feel weird. Like, you know, or it would feel like it the same kind of way that he's like touching and running his hands over like Maggie's hair. But it's violent because it's happening with a knife. I just don't know why we use sexual violence for story.
Well, and I definitely have some opinions about what happens with this. So for other characters, not just Maggie.
Yeah.
Put a pin in it.
For later. And then we cut to the rescue party, and all I wrote down is, not a minute too soon, guys. Chop fucking chop. Like, get there now.
No joke.
My God.
And again, but Rick and Daryl have this heart to heart. I know. Like,
they're my bro TP. That's what I wrote down.
Oh, I love that bro TP. That's great.
Well, and I do occasionally ship them too. I think their relationship is so fascinating.
I can see that. Yeah, I ship it.
I know. And so they're talking about the baby and Judith. And they're like, Rick says, you know, I know what you did for me, for my baby, while I was working things out. I'm glad you're back with it enough to understand what Daryl has been doing.
I'm glad that it's recognized. I'm glad that there's a moment where it's like, yeah, I wasn't able to be a caretaker and you took care of my family. Yeah. So thank you.
And Daryl's response is, it's what we do. And it's like, yeah, because you are family. Because you're family. And you love each other.
But then what ruins this perfect moment? Walkers everywhere, every which way, so many walkers, they're all coming. Michonne is impressed by how they're all handling themselves.
Yeah.
She does notice that. Mm-hmm. But then they all have to end up running to this shack because this is all action, action, action. We go to this shack, and it does not smell nice in this shack that they have boarded up.
There's a dead dog in there. Nice. And then they go, guess Lassie went home, is what Daryl says. You know, then they end up finding Lassie's owner, who is not dead. And is crazy, maybe.
And was like, did you clock this? He was like literally hiding under the cover.
Oh, I thought he was asleep under the covers. I didn't necessarily think he was hiding.
Okay, well, maybe he...
And they scared him awake, and then he was like, I'll call the cops! Like,
I thought he was hiding under the covers with his gun.
Oh, maybe.
That's how I read it. I liked that he was asleep, too.
Yeah. But yeah, he starts shouting and yelling, and he's like, I'm gonna call the cops! And Rick goes, I am a cop! But good job, this guy, because his immediate response to that is, show me your badge! Which is like, yeah, don't just take it on faith that someone's a cop if they say they're a cop. Get that badge. But Rick does this really well, where he's like, I will, it's in my pocket. I'm just going to reach for it. And then he like lunges for this guy, and it's a grapple.
And Rick wins.
Rick does win. And then he puts the guy in a chokehold. And I definitely thought he was going to chokehold that guy to death. But the guy gets loose, and he's like running. And don't worry, Michonne stops him before he can open the door and stabs him through the chest with her katana.
Yeah, she doesn't really hesitate on that one. And because she hasn't said very much at this point in time as viewers, I think that we are also supposed to be like, is this person the safest person for you all to be around? But I love the assertiveness of it because the guy needed to die. He was going to mess this all up.
Daryl has another quip, though, as the walker intensifies around the shack. And he says, y'all remember the Alamo?
Yeah. And that inspires him to a really great plan, which is that they take the dead guy and they toss him to the front, out the front entrance as like a tasty distraction. And then the rest of them hightail it out the back, Michonne, you know, leading the way.
This was the other shot that I noticed was just like, it felt very much like it was unnecessary, but we got it anyway, where like we focus a lot on them tearing apart the body.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of like bloody guts stuff with this kill.
Yeah, and so I don't know if they were just trying to fill time or what. We just haven't like focused on a bloody death of somebody that we haven't known in quite a while. Mm-hmm. So,
and we're back in experiment dungeon, which is slightly different than torture dungeon. And Andrea and Milton look kind of bored. Like, it's been a while. Like, they've just been waiting for this guy to turn, and it's been taking a while because it's so variable when people turn and when they don't. And then, like...
Yeah, I think to, like, rewind back to Jenner, he said, like, the quickest they had on record was 2 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and the longest had been, like, 8 hours or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt like it was more than that. But, like, yeah, there's variety, and Shane turned super quick, and some people... And Amy turned after, like, a whole night, so... and they both look bored. But then Coleman starts to stir and like, and they do this really well. And it's actually very similar to the way that they did Amy's reanimation, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's pretty subtle at first. It's just like his eyes are blinking open and his head moves a little. And it almost does just look like someone who is like sort of fighting their way awake and he's kind of uncoordinated. And Milton immediately is like, oh my God, okay. Like, showtime. My name is Milton Mamet. Like, and he starts going through his spiel, and he does, and the music, they turn on the music, they do the bowl, you know, and Milton starts going through his questions, but it doesn't seem to be getting a response until the picture of Coleman's wife, and then Coleman's hand, like, twitches. And
well, it just sort of grips the mattress,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, sort of, like, it contracts, right? And Milton is like, oh my God, like, oh my God, look, he moved. And Andrea's like, nope, that's just like a muscle contraction. That's normal. And he's so invested and he seems really hopeful that actually this is going to work. And Andrea's like, you're fucking crazy. I'm not untying him. And Milton goes for it anyway. And he starts asking the question, since Coleman is no longer restrained, he of course goes for Milton immediately. And Andrea just stabs him in the head and it's over. Like, really, really quickly, it's over. And that's months of work, right? That's like probably the entirety of the apocalypse. They've been doing something like this, or at least the past couple of months. And it's like, yep, that's it. It's done.
Well, and to your point, too, that Milton didn't have any friends. Like, this is somebody who he consistently talked to that wasn't the governor for months.
Yeah.
And now he's gone. So that really sucks. Like my notes really just is like, Milton is shook and sad and it's not funny. It's yeah. just really sad because no, he's just really, like, I'm going to go write my notes while they're still fresh, I guess.
Yeah, I know. I'd like to record my findings. And he like kind of retreats to like lick his wounds because he's sad. His friend is dead and he didn't get any useful data out of that. And then we go to torture dungeon. Slightly different than experiment dungeon. Because it is fascinating they didn't even give that guy a room with windows. Right? I didn't see any windows in there.
I didn't see any windows in there.
It's a secret. Yeah. And we know Milton has another lab where he was, like, dissecting Michonne's walkers.
Yeah.
So it's like, how many secret labs are there in Woodbury? Why can't they just have, like, an open, normal lab?
They have a secret dungeon. They have a secret lab. They have the second secret lab. They have the secret lab that not even the secret labs know about. Yeah.
They have a lot of secrets. The secret infirmary where the helicopter guy died. Like, is there a whole secret city underneath Woodbury? Like, potentially.
That's fantastic.
But yeah, so we're in a different part of the secret, you know, catacomb city under Woodbury. And Glenn, I couldn't tell if the table leg on Glenn's arm was just the same as it had been in the previous scene, or if he had, it like almost looked like he'd jury-rigged it a little bit too. Like he'd been sharpening it on the stone or something. It looked way lethal because Merle and Martinez come in and they're like, hold it. But, and he like menaces them with his chair leg. But then the thing that really stops him is the governor pulls Maggie in and she's still shirtless because he's a fucking monster. And like Glenn's face, I mean, actually both their faces, right? Where both of them look just horrified to see the other, where they clearly are both projecting that the other one has been tortured way worse than them. And the governor's like, we're through with games. Now one of you is going to give up your camp. And I'm like, I don't think you are through with games. I think you're going to keep playing games with these people until you're bored.
Well, and the thing too, like in a similar way, I think for the Carol and Rick moment earlier this episode, where like seeing her and having to say that this is something that happened, like made it real. In this moment, like the fact that like they can now see each other, Maggie and Glenn, like it's making whatever has happened to them very real. And like they don't know how to process it at all because they're trying to process what has happened to them, but mostly what has happened to the other person that they can't possibly know yet. And it's all gross. And then the governor threatens Glenn, threatens Maggie first with a gun, and Glenn sort of like moves to do something about it. But then the governor has a quote unquote better idea, and instead he threatens Glenn with the gun.
I know, he goes for Glenn, and Maggie can't do anything other than just like say it, right? And she just blurts out the prison, and it almost seems like, I don't want to say it's like, it seems like she's not fully in control of her actions, because I do think she is. And I think she's like, I can't let this happen. But it's a thing where it's like almost a reflex, right? Where it's like, I cannot let Glenn get killed. Yeah. And she says the prison, and everyone's like, no way, it's the prison. That place is overrun.
10 people could not have cleared the whole prison.
Yeah, I know. But I do, this is one like small little light here is Maggie's like 10, you know, we have 10 people now. And I did just write, no, Maggie, it's 11. Carol is there waiting for you. Carol's there. It's 11. And then the governor decides to just like fuck with Maggie a little bit more, which is why I think his statement of we're done with games is total bullshit, because there's no reason to do anything to Maggie after she gave you the information that you wanted, except that it's fun to fuck with her.
Well, and specifically, he likes fucking with her, but he's also really enjoying that it's fucking with Glenn. He's, like, loving it on all levels. It's all fucked.
He's, like, amazing. This was so much fun when it was one person, and now I've got double trouble. It's, like, ugh, it's horrible. And, yeah, he's just, you know, he's touching her face, and he's getting all in her personal space. And I do want to say, like, I hate all of this, but I do think Lauren Cohen's, like, stiff body resistance in this moment is really, really good. I think it's hard to depict someone like fighting back without physically punching or pushing or anything, but she's just like full, like she's just refusing to like move with his hand the way he seems to want her to move. And what's fast? And then he like shoves her to Glenn, and she just hugs him and is like sobbing. And then we get a shot of Merle.
And Merle does not look happy.
Yeah, he does not actually seem into this.
Seems like Merle has a line, and who knew that Merle had a line?
Yeah,
like he does. This crossed it somehow.
And, you know, they leave Maggie and Glenn, and they're then arguing. They're still arguing, Martinez, the governor, and Merle about, like, whether or not this thing about the prison is a lie, right? And especially the governor is now, like, really putting this on Merle. This thing of, like, if they're not lying, then this group, with your brother at its core, did something you told me couldn't be done.
Well, and it also, I don't know if you feel this way at all, but for me, it was the first time, too, that I felt like the governor actually felt the pressure of this group. Mm-hmm. That if they were able to take over that prison with 10 people, like, these are not people that we can fuck with. And also, your brother's in that group. And I really don't like that your brother is now confirmed to be out there and alive, and that you seem really excited to get back to him. So you're going to have to declare your allegiance to me right now.
I know.
Right? Because we're going to have to go take care of this shit.
It is wild to me, though. The governor has turned on a like, the governor now seems super paranoid about Merle, right? Where he's like, well, your brother could be out there right now searching for them. Blood is blood, right? Makes me wonder where your loyalties lie. First point, if you had let Merle go and find his brother sooner, none of this would be happening. But also, it's so fascinating to me that this is the thing that makes the governor suddenly start to question that, like, Merle is loyal to him, when it's like, there's an actual reason to question this, which is Merle showed up earlier today being like, oh no, like Shumpert, or not Shumpert, Shumpert's still there, but like Gargiulio, Crowley, and, you know, Timmy, whatever, lost Michonne's head and sword. Like, you know, it's fascinating that he doesn't seem to have picked up that's the genuine, you know, quote unquote betrayal. But I do love, there's a lot of brother talk in this section. Mm-hmm. I love a lot is that we keep cutting back and forth between Merle and Daryl's faces, right? We have this whole scene going down with Merle and the governor, and then we have Daryl, Rick, and everyone else sort of getting into position to assault the Woodbury walls. Mm-hmm. And I just loved this, right? I loved this contrast of two right-hand men to two different leaders. Like, these brothers that have something, like, there is something interesting there, that there's some level of, like, commitment or loyalty or something like that, that somehow is people see in this moment, right? There's a reason that they've both, and they're strong and they're capable, and, like, there's a reason they've both sort of worked their way up these ranks and are being recognized. Mm-hmm. But one of them is serving someone who is ultimately rotted at the core, right? He's twisted, and so nothing good could ever come of it. And of course, Merle is also twisted, but Daryl's not. And Daryl, therefore, has, like, somehow become the right-hand man to someone. Good. This is the thing that excites me about Merle being back. It's not that I'm like, more racism, more torture. It's that I'm like, these are two very complicated people with a bond and a connection, and by learning about one of them, we learn about the other one in different ways.
I was going to say, it's not more moral, more racism. It's more character development. Yeah. That's what Margo loves.
Backstory, and we want a t-shirt. Backstory.
You just like, I want to get you a t-shirt that says more character development.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Because that's really what it's all about for you, in all capital letters and in exclamation points. And I agree with you. Like, there's a reason why I like having Merle on the show too. And it has nothing to do with, like, the racist stuff that we probably didn't talk about enough this episode. But, like, you know, is there. It's entirely just, like, trying to figure out this sibling dynamic that shaped these people into who they are.
And how do they become these two people is the interesting thing, right? How do we get the Merle and the Daryl? Why are they not the same is the fascinating part.
Well, but we, of course, can't end this end this episode with the brother stuff. We have to end it with Andrea and the governor.
The last thing we see from the group, though, is that they are, like, they're on one side of the wall, like, creeping up to it. And then it's like the camera follows over the wall and, like, follows someone climbing down from, like, guard posts, and they walk past Andrea, and then we follow Andrea into the house. And I was like, oh, this is kind of a good, you know, I enjoy seeing the proximity here. Blah, Andrea. And I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah, especially, like, the full context of the governor's day now of, like, I just, like, sexually assaulted somebody for fun, and I'm torturing some other people for fun, and I'm swinging my big dick around, and I'm the biggest boy and on God's green earth, and, like, look at me go. And, like, for his, like, his first thing with her to be like, oh, you kept your word. And he's, like, so clearly, like, revved up right now in a way that makes me super uncomfortable. So I'm not going to talk much more about the governor. What I will say is that we get to see Andrea have a, like, processing Amy some more, because she, like, this is, I think, the moment that I realized, for me anyway, that it felt like she was kind of hopeful that maybe the experiment would be okay, and it wasn't. And so that does mean that there was nothing left of her sister.
I know. But it is interesting, because I felt the same way, right? That the reason she has to go for this whiskey is because she's like, it didn't work. But it is fascinating of, like, imagine how messed up she would be if it did work. And she was like, oh, I killed the thing that was holding the last traces of my sister. And then my sister knew that I killed her. Like, that seems so dark that I wonder if she thought through what happens if that's true. But it feels like she's not going that direction. She's going the direction of, like, if that's the first step, then the next step is maybe trying to figure out how to pull that unconscious knowledge forward. And just, like, even the smallest instant of thinking that thought is immediately, like, smacked down. And it's like, nope, it's never going to happen. But I got the same feeling, right?
Well, to add to bring it full circle to the title, you know, this was Amy coming knocking too in a certain way for Andrea this episode, right? Yeah. Like the thing that she's not trying to think about, but is definitely the dead person on her mind always. Mm.
And then the last thing that happened in this episode, which is like the worst fucking thing I've ever seen, is the governor like pulls, like Andrea is clearly drinking and upset about the outcome of the experiment. And the governor goes over and, you know, pulls her to him in like an embrace and runs a hand over her head going, hey, shh, it's okay, it's over. And it's mimicking what he just did to Maggie so much. And Andrea has no idea. And that is how these people work. It is not that like everyone is a mustache twirling villain. Like people do horrible things and then they just go on with their day because they're horrible people.
Yeah.
Because she never, if she knew what had happened. Mm. And my last note is the one thing I can promise, it is definitely not over.
It's definitely not over. No. Yeah. I am glad that we got through this episode, though, because this episode is hard. And we didn't even talk about, like, we talked about this off mic, but, like, the comic run of the governor story is way worse.
Well, maybe we talk about that more when he does stuff later, because I'm sure it will remain relevant. So. He's a fucking monster here, and he's a fucking monster in the comics. Not shocking.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to cheerier subjects, or maybe cheerier subjects, depending on what kind of fan fictions you like. But what's in your fan fiction, Margo? What do you want to have happen? What do you want to see? What do you want our listeners, all four of them, to send to us?
I mean, here's what I've noticed for the, like, fan fiction section of this podcast is I actually am just saying the fan fiction I would like to write. Not necessarily like great or it's not like deep often, but it's the kind of thing that I like to read and that I am occasionally interested in writing, right? Which is looking at sort of the background events of like this apocalyptic world in more detail. And I was kind of like, well, this is how I can tell they're ones that I'm interested in writing because I think about the structure of them. But like, wouldn't it be great if you had one that was like, every time, similar to, I think I said this for Michonne and Andrea, right? Like the conversations they had on the road. But if you did like a fic that was just looking at all of these conversations of Milton and Mr. Coleman and like how he came to be of the opinion that he is like an amazing man and how did he build this friendship with this like guy when Milton is awkward and has no friends and like is a consummate loner. Like, how did that develop? And then you would just end it with the scene that we see on screen, thunk of Andrea's knife stabbing into his head. But it'd be really interesting. And I don't know that, I don't care that much about Milton, but I do think that actually is like an interesting thing that I haven't read or seen before. And something interesting too about like, yeah, what does happen when you have a degenerative illness? What has happened to all of the people with diabetes? Like, you know, and we don't really think about those things. So yeah, I had that. And then just always like Daryl. I would love some like Daryl, Carol, Nine Lives. Like I would love to see the original context of that. Where does that joke develop? Or not, it's not even a joke, but where does that inside comment develop?
Yeah, that's one of mine. That's one of mine for sure. It's just like, yeah, when more. Did that start? Yeah, I mean like that's, I mean the Nine Lives remember is just so like, yeah, I want to remember, Carol. I want us to know this moment. I want to know how you both were in danger and you both got out of it and how you both are cats with nine lives. I don't know if I have any other big ones. I mean, I think that like I'm in the beginning stages of a Rick Michonne idea, but we haven't seen enough of them yet to really warrant it. We've just seen a lot of intense eye contact, but I'm here for this intense eye contact. And I love how he picked her up. It was very hot. So I'm clocking those things. And then I just, I think for the future too, like, and I know where we go in this season, but still I wouldn't mind reading fan fiction that is just about the governor getting comeuppance.
Yeah, let's burn it.
That's what I would love.
Let's burn him.
I would just love that. I would just like that. Well, fantastic. Where can people find you, Margo?
The internet. I'm at mconnolly316 on Instagram. I'm at Margo_Connolly on Twitter. And I'm on New Play Exchange as Margo Connolly.
I'm at CMeek on Twitter and at CMeekSmeeker on Instagram. I'm at CMeeker on New Play Exchange. Don't Dead Pod is on Twitter, Instagram, and Gmail at Don't Dead Pod. And you can rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And we would love to read more of those. That'd be great. Yeah. And we also, of course, really want all of your fanfiction recommendations.
Yeah, fanfic.
Fantastic. All right. I think that's all I have. Is that all you got?
That is all I have.
Fantastic. This episode belongs to the dead now.
All right, bye.